So when was your last checkup? Oh no, not you. Although that's important too, but when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule an appointment today.
You want some perspective? Let's see, crime is rising and crime will be the issue. The issue in America in the midterm elections, just weeks away now. Another issue, as the hurricane hits the Florida coast, media is going to try to turn away from the dead of fentanyl. There's tens of thousands of people dead already as that border is porous like a sieve. And as all this is happening and you don't know how to deal with it and you're concerned about who's telling you what and what their agenda is, just know this, Charles Lipton is here, and if you're on the Chicago way, even though it's a little dark and the cobblestones are broken and the streets are bumpy, you can hear him. He'll guide you through. Jeff Carlin is here, too. He's holding the light. Jeff, WGN, AM, executive producer and future physics teacher, and maybe he'll tell you how light bends in the night. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com. As Pritzker calls people racist if they dare bring up his Safety Act failures, as the fentanyl dead remain closed and forgotten and cold by the media, except for their parents and a few odd detectives, they're ignored. And where are you with all this? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
And we're joined, as promised, by one of the great minds in the Midwest, Professor Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair, who writes at charleslipson.com, and you can see all his stuff. I think you're quite prolific. You have like three columns a week. You must be insane, like that Cass fellow. Putin's fresh cannon fodder and nuclear threats won't work. Charles Lipson, 26th of September, Newsweek, and then Spectator World, why Republican governors sent those immigrant buses. Oh, that's delicious. Mm-hmm. If I were smoking... Still smoking, Charles? I'd light one up right now to savor that.
And if I were still in college, I'd light up something different.
And the Biden administration enters Baghdad Bob territories on inflation and immigration. Charles, okay, these three topics are amazing, and you've got something else coming out on freedom of speech at college campuses.
I'm negotiating right now where it should come out, but the issue on college campus and free speech is a very, very important one, not only because it's essential to education on campus, but because the illiberalism on college campuses has now spread as these students have gone out into the working world. And the basic point is, if you feel uncomfortable or if the ideas are troubling to you, you now feel free to shut them down. And this has happened at many of our leading universities. But I try to go beyond that to say what universities can and should do to correct that, because there are measures to correct it. And some schools have done a lot better than others. At the very best of the list is the University of Chicago, I'm happy to say. And at the very worst is Columbia University, a very fine university, whose president is a specialist in free speech law.
How many of these, irony is dead as well. But how many of these people go on to become journalists and shut down debate? How many of these kids come out and become Jacobins in the journalism world and shut people down for posing
I think
ideas?
A lot of them would like to. I think the good news. I think the good news is that there are so many more outlets. Your podcast yes. being an example. The Tribune tried in various ways to shut you down, and you just went to another, to John Cass News. Set up your own website, and you, I think next week you'll have more subscribers in the Tribune.
But that's because, thank you, Charles, but that's because people like you stood up and defended me and prevented me from being.
Well, I appreciated the check, John. I really appreciated the check. I mean, I was on the fence for a long time.
If only I had known that it was so easy, I would have had you write for John Cass News by now. But I'd gladly pay you Tuesday for
I'll have my lawyer call your lawyer
column today. All right, so let's see the what we're facing in the next 8 weeks are the news media not wanting to cover the border, not wanting to get their friend Joe Biden upset. And so I guess they'll be rushing to Florida to cover the deadly hurricane. What is it? Ian.
Ian.
Ian? Ian?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they're blaming it on the Irish.
Yeah.
I just posted on various social media the following. Here is a surefire prediction. The national media will watch DeSantis' response to the hurricane with a microscope, looking for any flaws in the emergency response or the rebuilding effort. The mainstream media consider DeSantis a top contender for 2024, so sinking him is a high priority.
Which, if you're going to pick a target, that's a dumb target, in my opinion, because if anybody knows how to deal with a natural disaster, it's going to be Florida. I mean, it's not like this is their first go-around. And
well, you were talking about the media protecting or going after DeSantis. I looked up Stacey Abrams denies the baby has a heartbeat, and the Planned Parenthood comes to her rescue somehow by creating new science.
Well, you know, there's another odd aspect about this election, which is if you think about the two people who ran in the last election, Biden and Trump, each party has walked away from its nominee. The polling says, and the Democrats' strategy says, avoid Biden.
Yeah.
If Republicans could pay Biden to go into to contested states, they would do so. And the Republicans are doing the same about avoiding Trump, not in the primaries where he carries significant weight within the Republican Party, but he just alienates large numbers of independents, educated voters, especially women, and so forth. So both parties have walked away. And if you think about the third person who's run over the last 6 years, it's Hillary Clinton. And have you seen her anywhere?
Oh my God. Well, she has a show out that's getting, I haven't seen it, but I know it's right out there.
But on the campaign trail.
No,
you haven't
right.
seen have any you? Candidates want her near them.
No.
Wait, isn't she busy with her daughter, Chelsea?
Right.
And Susan Rice? And aren't they standing around or sitting around a boiling cauldron, passing an eye between them?
John, well, it's almost Halloween.
No, it's Macbeth.
Right on.
Well, It does seem like we have a kind of geriatric leadership class that is being rejected by the public. The polling shows that most Democrats, over half, don't want Biden to be their nominee next time around. And as the recession worsens, those numbers will worsen. Trump is a giant roadblock, I think, to the Republicans winning back the presidency. And the question is whether DeSantis will take him on. Others will take him on, but I don't think they can get past him. And the problem with getting past Trump is that you have to not only get past him, but you have to, he will come at you, you know, hammer and tongs, and you have to later be able to get his voters to vote for you in the general election.
I'm not sure. I mean, I've been told all my life that the ideal thing is for people to vote for the good, for something that they support. Like, I like this man. Mm-hmm. I will support this man. Mm-hmm. But I guess now that I'm in my old age and becoming bitter and about to scream at clouds any moment.
Get off my lawn, politics.
I think it also, politics is also driven by, hey, right. I might not agree with my guy, but you know what? I hate you guys even more. Well, and I think that's something that's animating our politics now. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think
not just our politics. I mean, all sorts of aspects of life. It seems these days, even if we don't believe politically with somebody, then we're all of a sudden mortal enemies. It seems like more and more people are just, you know, I can't be around that person. They're this, all right.
And I don't think the left understands how much I despise them. I'm sorry, but it's true now.
I do think that most of our elections in recent years have been throw the bums out elections.
Yeah.
I thought what was so brilliant about the way that David Axelrod pitched the Obama campaign in 2008, Hope and Change, was it was a throw the bums out election, which he pitched as these vague, you know, sort of ink blot terms, hope and change. They mean whatever you want them to mean. But after that, it's been mostly just throw the bums out. And I would say, and we've talked about this before, John and Jeff, is that there has always been, or for a long time, been in American politics a kind of overriding notion of what I would call civic nationalism. That is, it doesn't sort of matter where your ancestors came from. Ultimately, the overriding identity is unifying. When that split apart, we had a civil war. Of course, it's understandable that a lot of that there was racism and unforgivable racism, and that blacks didn't feel that they were part of that unity, and oftentimes they were right. I think what's changed in the last couple of decades has been a kind of intellectual movement that's taken wider hold in the society that emphasizes these distinct identities and often pits them against each other, which is very corrosive to our sense of civic unity.
I mean, I think you're dead on there. I think it's more prevalent in the left. I mean, John, you and I have talked about this too, but that this idea of divide and conquer, kind of, where if the left, which has done for years, at least my whole lifetime, has tried to, you know, corral people into their own little pens to show that, hey, you're unique and special in your own little group, but right. collectively, you know, you're this other group over here is worse to all of you. Like that idea that they can choose us out. Whereas I feel like conservatives, and again, just in my lifetime, from what I've experienced, seem to be the idea of more of the idea of, well, it doesn't matter who you are. We all have to be treated equally, and power should be, you know, the person's power. Because I've been going back and reading some, you know, histories and listening to podcasts about old, you know, elections from Washington all the way through. And that mentality that you were just talking about, Charles, the idea of like bringing us together, coalescing us as a union and being these United States, it, you know, I don't think that means anything to anybody anymore, because we've been, because we've had one group on one side saying, you know, the government is terrible, we need less government, and the other side of the group saying, hey, everybody, you know, we can protect ourselves, we can be our, you know, think about your own people first. And I don't know how you get back to that without, you know, another civil war or something, you know, aliens, right, John? As you always talk about, that's the only thing that'll bring us together if we're being invaded.
Getting our juices sucked out through alien straws, yeah, as they exactly. Walk them with 10 foot long legs.
Well, I think that something subtle and cumulatively important happened. I think that on the left in particular, the Democratic Party was always about building an additive coalition. You put together the unions and you put together African Americans and you put together this group and that group, and you added them all up. And of course, you gave government benefits in selective ways to each to get them into an additive coalition. But intellectually, on campus and so forth, a lot of these movements have become much more divisive. And they've also, especially on the far left, the progressive left, have taken an attitude that America is fundamentally a bad country, that its foundation was founded in
sin,
racism, and slavery, right. And that the idea that Thomas Jefferson wrote all men are created equal and so forth was just a hoax. And so all of this, and it's just one long list of betrayals, when you add that then there's no overarching tent. So every group is pitted against each other, and any larger grouping is itself devalued. And I think that that's really harmful. Mm-hmm. And I think, which is not to downplay the fact that there's been a rise of white supremacy on the very far right.
Right.
And a lot of it justifies itself falsely by saying, you know, they're trying to replace us, it's all these other groups and so forth. But these are very noxious elements in public life.
Well, I do tend to think that the reason some of them think that way is because media and the leftist fever swamp, which is Twitter, has been full for years of sort of taunts and bragging about replacing these Europeans as soon as we can, and then we'll feel better about ourselves once we have them excised.
And but I you think, can see, John, you can really see now. What? You can really see now in the polling that the public is furious about disorder in the cities, this yes. widespread lawlessness. They're increasingly upset about open southern border, not only because of immigrant, it violates our basic notion that you need our permission to come into the country, but also because this fentanyl epidemic is being fueled by it. And all of this is coming now under the Biden presidency. Remember, there was 1.7% inflation when Trump left office, and now Biden tells us is zero inflation, but that's just lunacy.
And the pandemic's over.
There's over 8% inflation, and all he really was trying to say in his fumbling way was that it hadn't gone up
right
month to month. But it now looks like the Federal Reserve is determined to raise interest rates high enough to choke off this rampant inflation. And when they do, we're moving into a much more serious recession.
We'll be there, according to some estimates I've read, all the way through 2025.
Recessions don't last that long. If it lasts that long, it'll be a depression.
Yeah.
But we have no anticipation of that. But I must say that the rest of the developed world is also moving into recession, and the situation with Russian fuel being cut off to Europe is also very serious.
I mean, and the mild upside there being that is, you know, the whole world is facing ridiculous inflation right now. The U.S. is actually on the lower end of that scale as far as what we're experiencing at the moment. But, you know, we may just be ahead of where we were. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of things at play there. But it's an interesting point about the fentanyl thing, too, because, John, you and I were talking about this the other day a little bit, and how it's, you know, this mentality of, I don't know, it feels like one, a conflagration of things. Like, obviously, the war on drugs, which was it seemingly didn't do anything other than just reorder South America.
Well, drugs won.
Yeah, we're drugs won, right? Exactly. And then, you know, compound that with the immigration crisis, the stuff that comes out of that. But no one talks about it. I mean, we always see stories about it, and everyone's like, oh, wring your hands and you hang your head. And you could talk to probably every sheriff in the county, in the city or the state, rather, of Illinois, will tell you that their officers are tired of trying to revive people and having to go to people's houses to see what they see. And it's just people overdosing on fentanyl, and it's growing to a point where it's almost one of the largest killers of young people in this country is fentanyl.
And now these vending machines, there are these vending machines where you can buy the antidote, just pull a lever and get it, which tells you how prevalent the problem really is.
That's what Narcan.
What you were talking about earlier about a civic nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
I think applies when you think I'd written a column about this a while back and asked or fantasized that I wanted to see all the parents of the fentanyl dead surrounding the White House. And I didn't think many showed up this time, but there still were more people out there in front of the White House. But I've noticed that, the media does not want to deal with this. They don't want to deal with fentanyl dead. They'd rather deal with down power lines and let's see pictures of DeSantis and Biden in baseball caps and windbreakers, khakis, walking up and down, you know, palm-strewn, destroyed streets,
right?
Pointing their fingers like at crews, you know, like be men of action.
And, well, they know how to cover that. They know how to cover these kinds of disasters, and they are important to cover. But as you say, and you know, of course, they'll use it also as a way to talk about global warming and so forth. Even though there've been fewer hurricanes in the past year than in recent years, but I mean, there are global warming problems. But it seems to me that they are constantly shooting themselves in the foot at the White House, and they are absolutely determined on this.
Baghdad Bob, as you said, your piece
is fantastic, Charles.
Oh, thank you.
That's hilarious.
I was a kid, you know, I was younger when that stuff all happened, and then it reminded me of it. I went back and watched some of his videos, and I was like a kid again, enjoying war from a faraway place.
Baghdad Bob would stand in front of falling bombs and tell you everything was well. It was kind of like Leslie Nielsen in some of those Naked Gun movies where the whole thing is exploding and he's saying, everything is just fine here. Go away.
Isn't that Karine Jean-Pierre?
Oh, the God. Press secretary,
doing the same thing, right?
She's
doubling down.
Yeah.
She's dreadful. And she does. I mean, look. They've got to spin bad news. Right. I understand that it's not a good job, but the fact is she's not very good at it. And she has to look whenever she's asked a question, she has to sort of thumb through her book to find what's been typed up as an answer. Then she reads it and it reminds me of undergraduates on an essay exam, and you ask them a question, what started World War I? And they don't know the answer, and they say, that reminds me of what started World War II.
Well, isn't it, you? Or I guess the question is, you might want to ask, what started World War II? And the answer would be, World War I never ended, and we just went into World War II.
Well, actually, one of the leading French politicians, generals, at the end of the Versailles Peace Conference after World War I,
yes,
said, this isn't a peace, this is a truce for 20 years, and he was off by 1 month.
Yes.
So, yeah, but my point was just, sometimes when you don't have the answer, you just answer a different question. And if you're going to do that, you have to be pretty smooth. Otherwise, it just looks like you don't have an answer. And
she does not.
Yeah. And she does.
But we have yeah. Charles Lipson here with us, and news is breaking. For example, number one, we have a movement in Italy that elected a conservative mom, female woman, God fearing, speaking in terms of her message has been about God, family, and country, which now apparently, according to our media, is neo-fascism.
Well,
what say you, Professor?
I simply don't know enough. You know, there's a great line that Clint Eastwood uses in one of his movies: a man's got to know his limitations. And in this case, I just don't feel like I've done enough studying about what they're doing in Italy to really know. I've confined myself to every other issue in the world.
Well, I get a sense that
yes,
when they started, you know, because part of the news now is not really striking out independently. It's waiting for a consensus to be built.
Right.
And this is the dangerous part in the news business, when breaking news happens and there is no consensus, because then there's a lot of panicking going on in the pundit world. But I see now the consensus is she's a conservative, therefore she must be a fascist, or in this case, according to the Washington Post, repackager of toxic populism.
Well,
what is with them? These people are just, I was among them for 40 years, and as I left, I thought, did I spend my time in the house of the rising sun, like dissolutely, where the lies were told and everybody wanted to be loved? Oh, you're so wonderful. I love you. Oh, you're so wonderful. The politician tells the journalist. Is that where I was living for 40 years?
Well, first of all, the Washington Post is a paper in a company town, and the company town has kind of one view. It's the permanent government. It voted about over 95% for Biden in the last election, and if you looked at the people with college educations and so forth, you would see similar numbers. The New York Times is a paper for published by people in Manhattan who live in Manhattan or Brooklyn Heights, and they have all the same views, and they're simply not exposed to other people. I think that the issue of populism always has had a very dark side. Certainly
since Jackson.
Huh? Well,
since Jackson.
Less Jackson, I'm thinking, and less William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah, okay.
But in the South, in Georgia, this is before Stacey Abrams was elected governor last time in her mind,
right?
But not actually in the ballots.
Unfortunately,
in the late 1800s, there was a man named Tom Watson who was kind of the original Southern agrarian populist, and he tried to build a black-white coalition, and it failed. And after it failed, he became an ardent racist and rebuilt his populist movement as a racist movement. And in the South, his successors were people like George Wallace. So there was always a possibility. James K. Vardaman in Mississippi and so forth. There were Lester Maddox in Georgia.
And they were boycotting the Greek candy stores in Atlanta and all the way through the South in those days.
Really? Yeah. I didn't know that. I mean, there were Greeks, white.
We've talked
Jews.
About this. Yeah, yeah, they were going after. They were killing Jews. They were just not letting us sell let Greeks sell caramel candies or something.
Well, you know, it was apples. Interesting. If you remember David Duke, the Ku Klux Klansman in Louisiana,
yeah,
he almost won the governorship. He ran against a flamboyant and very corrupt and sexually very active guy named Edwin Edwards, who had bumper stickers that said things like "Elect the crook," meaning me, Edwin Edwards. "Elect the crook. It's important." And our guy is better under the sheets than their guy.
Oh,
but what's interesting? One of the things that was interesting about David Duke was that he won the white vote in Louisiana. And that was only possible because the Klan, which once was virulently anti-Catholic, had dropped that. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you couldn't mm-hmm. win that vote in Louisiana. So they had kind of adopted. And people don't realize, of course, that the second Ku Klux Klan, the first one being in the 1870s or 80s, whenever it was, but the one in the 1920s, the biggest state for the Klan was Indiana.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to speak about that because I don't drive south, but I did have a good conversation with my new neighbors. I went into and which brings us to the issue that I want to talk about next.
Yeah.
I went into the gun store. Okay. Mm-hmm. I went into a gun store and said, "What are the rules? You know, I just want to be a law-abiding citizen, but what are the rules?" And there's a guy behind the counter, big guy, and he said, "You're John Cass, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am. Thank you." And he goes, "He was a Serbian from a seminary, a seminarian." Mm-hmm. who was at St. Michael Archangel, which is in the 10th Ward, a storied parish there. And he said, "Yeah, you're from Chicago, so let me tell you, you come from a communist country. and now you're asking about guns, but I am here to tell you, Mr. Cass, that now you live in America, where people can care, the Constitution allows you to protect yourself in Indiana." And it struck me, Charles, that is that why there's such not so much crime? I mean, there is crime everywhere, but it's just not the same as in Chicago, just a few minutes by car from where you are. And I was thinking, is what about crime is the issue facing us now with the Safety Act and Governor Pritzker demanding and cajoling?
Well, you should say what the Safety Act is, because if there's ever been a misnamed law, that is it.
Oh, certainly.
It makes me safe just saying it, Charles.
Right. Well, we did dive into it last week about it, but the Safety Act is, as some people may know, it essentially eliminates cash bail in Illinois and goes into effect on January 1st, 2023. Passed 2 years ago at 5 a.m., an 800-page bill. And anybody I've talked to who's ever either had signed, voted for it, or has seen it, it wasn't light reading. There's no way anybody read it. And
well, I thought that the key provision was that if you shoot somebody, it's an $18 fine and just send it in.
Well, we you have to get caught by one of those shooting speed cameras.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man's got to know his limitations.
But okay, Safety Act is a big deal in Illinois.
But you've got people who no longer think that the streets are safe, and that's been true for a long time in minority communities on the South Side and the West Side.
Mm-hmm.
We've now seen some of that spread to other neighborhoods, and we've seen problems downtown.
Yeah.
And what I've been trying to think, what is it? I mean, the causes of crime are one issue, but what strikes me is the near total breakdown of the willingness of ordinary bourgeois people who get married, have two kids, you know, try to pay on a mortgage on their house, you know, that sort of thing. A breakdown of their willingness to actually enforce the law. They somehow don't think that they have a legitimate right to say to the whole, to everyone, you can't
do that.
Walk in and smash, and trash a store and smash all the glass and steal all the watches. Right. And if you do, you're going to be staying in jail, because you're a threat, until we can get you into court. And then we're not going to let you plead down, to the point where it's like a parking ticket.
2 years ago, we had a discussion like this around a subject that is not associated with, violence in the country, but I associate it. It was the Democratic mayors of every big city, almost courting or at least appeasing Black Lives Matter and the people who were organizing from the hard left, those George Floyd protests. And I've always considered George Floyd a victim of police murder, and have written so and said so. But what was going on was sort of like a weaponizing of discourse for the November elections, the presidential elections to come, in which Biden met Trump. And I don't think the American people have forgotten those times. I think they will never forget wondering, honey, why can't we have a gun if we live in Chicago? Why can't we just go and get one? And all that came with the fear.
Yeah, and there were riots all the summer. Yeah. And when the Democrats met in Milwaukee, they didn't mention them. They just tried to ignore the issue. They're now saying, of course, that they were on the other side of the issue. But the problem is, all these cities are governed by progressive Democratic mayors, and they're in a near total meltdown. And the epicenter is Minneapolis, which used to be one of the safest cities in the country. And which is where the George Floyd riots happened. But nobody is saying that any of these things have anything to do with social justice. So what I'm trying to understand is why it is. And the people in New York, after all, elected a former policeman to be the mayor, and he seems to have collapsed entirely.
Well, because he can't handle the, Soros prosecutor in Alvin Bragg in New York, no more than Mayor Lightfoot could handle Kim Fox.
Surprise.
And then, and so Lori decided, go full Phallus Maximus and support Kim Fox for re-election, and she wonders why people are just waiting for her to leave.
And then when she has, and then the head of McDonald's who has, you know, venues all over Chicago and is trying to hire people to work and to come into work and says, look, safety's a real problem here. And then her response is he needs to educate himself. Well, I would say his problem is not lack of education. His problem was that he spoke truth to ignorance. Right. I mean, to just sheer blindness.
Mm-hmm. So how will all this manifest itself? You're the political scientist at this table. We're just journalists. How does this manifest itself in the elections to come in November and then the one after?
Well, it's impossible to speak about the 2024 election. We just don't. It's just too far away. Yeah. But I think the one that's coming now, the question is how big will the red wave be in the House of Representatives? How big will the margin be for Republicans? And then it's surprising that the Senate looks actually close. I mean, it could be that the Republicans will take it. It could be that they won't. But given the fact that there's inflation, we're in a recession, there's crime problems, the border is open, it's just shocking that the party out of power, the one that's not associated with those, is not in a far, far stronger position. And part of that has to do with the fact that when the Republicans nominated, a number of their nominees were relatively weak or inexperienced candidates. And then the Democrats, who've been saying that Trump is a threat to democracy, and people who vote for Trump are a threat to a democracy.
The president says that.
We're actually donating millions of dollars to these Trump candidates because they thought that they could be beat. Well, that's maybe smart politics, but you can't make the argument that these people are a real threat, and yet we want to fund their campaigns. It's just it's a level of cynicism that's normally hidden rather than exposed.
Yeah,
I don't think people have forgotten the summer of 2020 or the fear that they felt, and I don't think they'll ever forget that. At least those who lived through the riots as we did when we moved, Betty and I moved into the city, giving Lori Lightfoot a chance and Governor Pritzker a chance, and we're going to think about investing here and we're going to move here.
Well, people are voting with their feet, as you did. This is the first time I think in history that California has lost population. It's certainly lost representatives. Illinois has lost. New York State has lost. The Northeast has lost. It may be that the best governed city in the country right now is Miami, and it's the only large city that's governed by a Republican. It's making a real move to try to be to recruit all of these refugees from the North, not just people who are going there for the winter, but people who want to move there.
And
Texas and Tennessee has done the same. Nashville has been a real growing area of very high priced houses now and all the rest.
Can't we go into real estate, Charles, and sell like Mississippi to snowbirds? The Gulf?
No.
Bubba Grump shrimps.
Well, let me just say, as somebody from the Mississippi Delta, which is just below Memphis, when the temperature in the summer is 100 and so is the humidity, it's real, and the land is flat as a pancake. It's real hard to convince people to move there.
Yeah, but I think you got to just give them a plate of steaming hot shrimp and grits, spicy shrimp and grits. That'll take care of it.
You are absolutely talking about one of my favorite dishes, and there is a place in Hyde Hyde Park now that makes a really good shrimp and grits. In fact, there are two places that make a really good shrimp and grits.
Let's hear. Where are they?
Well,
they're not sponsors of this show, so this is like
unsolicited. One of them is called Messler. It's on 53rd Street. It's in a little boutique hotel, and its shrimp and grits is really excellent. And then the other is got a real New Orleans name, Roux, R-O-U-X, Roux.
Butter and flour. Butter and flour, my friend.
That's right. That's right, as they say in New Orleans. It's on 55th Street at the university, almost at Cottage Grove, on 55th Street. And it's just really good shrimp and grits and some other treats as well. So I like that. But you know that grits were illegal for school lunches for a while?
No, why?
Well, it's a good example of unintended consequences and how the government can kind of move in to take over things. Remember when Michelle Obama got into the healthy food kick?
Yeah, that was terrible. None of the kids liked her food. Yeah.
Right. And the key person, by the way, was her chef.
Right.
His last name, I hesitate to tell you, John, was the same as yours.
Cass.
Yes.
Yeah, but guess what? My Uncle Leon, your former colleague and eminent bioethicist at the University of Chicago, my Uncle Leon.
Yeah.
I'll just tell the guys at the Tribune he was my uncle, and they're like, really? All the science writers, they were like, really? Leon Kess is your uncle?
I believe that the first time I booked him to your show.
When he came on, right? He's a great guy.
Well, this is yet another Kess from Hyde Park. The father taught it in the lab school. And the son, you know, was from Hyde Park, and he became the chef. And they put in all of these good food ideas for kids. There were a couple of problems. One was that the kids didn't eat the stuff.
Yeah. Right.
The second was, even if they did, you would need to check their diets to see if they then went after school and just gorged on chocolate or whatever.
Or pizza, which they considered actually a very good food.
Yes, exactly.
A big mistake was made when Michelle Obama, it was typical central planning Marxist horse poop, okay?
Yeah.
You cannot. Here's what you do. You want the kids to eat lunch? Hire the grandmothers, okay, of every neighborhood. You know what I mean? Like, you hire the grandmothers in certain neighborhoods, and guess what? On Wednesdays, we're eating oxtails, okay? And everyone's like, yeah, grandma, okay, come on. Let's have oxtails. And you pick them up, and they're juicy, and you stick your face in there, and you get all that meat out of there.
You can't even bring homemade food to schools anymore.
So when she put in that thing, there were such limits on carbohydrates that you couldn't, that these southern schools that normally serve grits for lunch couldn't do it. But here's, to me, an interesting element of it. For the hundreds of years of the American Republic, school lunches were always a responsibility of the local school board. And there was no law that ever changed that said, no, we don't want the local school board to handle school lunches. Those will be dictated from Washington. Nobody ever said that. What they did do, however, was a good thing, which was that they made money available to schools, to make sure that poor kids didn't have to pay for a school lunch. And that's now been extended to breakfast and dinner. And so there are schools that basically provide poorer children, and sometimes all the children, with all of their meals. But as soon as the government starts doing that, it says, well, you can't choose what you're going to serve them for meals. We're paying for it. So we're going to tell you. And that's exactly what happened here. And then And then who tells them? Well, the Congress was never going to pass a rule that says, here's what's a good school lunch. Right. They're going to say it's up to, you know, the Department of Education or the Department of Health and Human Services, something like that.
Yeah.
And then they're going to pass a rule, and it says you can't have this carbohydrates or right. that carbohydrate.
Were they going to ask
based on some expert?
Yeah, they're going to based on some experts, and or maybe not, just based on a mid-level bureaucrat.
Experts. But
the point
in quotes
is, this is actually one of the things going back to populism that's fueled a lot of populism. People feel like they're being ruled by right. people they didn't elect.
Yeah.
And I didn't elect you to tell me I can't have my spicy shrimp and grits. Kick it up a notch because I got to have it. And I you know what? I almost feel like driving over to Downers Grove right now and seeing my friend Jimmy because he's got Juicio's on
50. Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Which I tell you, my favorite place for this kind of food is that on my trips when I drive down from Chicago to Memphis, I stop at a place called Lambert's. Home of the Throwed Rolls. Have you ever heard of it?
Mm-mm.
No, but
in the Boot Hill of Missouri, although one of the children must have moved down to the what they call the Redneck Riviera in Alabama, Gulf Shores, and just before you get into Gulf Shores, there's another one. But Lambert's Home of the Throwed Rolls, and it's in the Boot Hill of Missouri, just over from Southern Illinois, and you stop in there and you would order something like a chicken fried steak and you'd get, you know, and you'd get a couple of vegetables. And then people come around with buckets of things like fried okra and grits and dish them up for free onto your plate. And except for one thing, rolls. And those they throw to you.
All right, what about dropping them? Because
I was once, there was once like a four-year-old kid at one of the next booths.
Oh, you could give it to the four-year-old kid if it drops.
No. They threw it gently to him. You would have thought he caught the home run in the seventh game of the World Series.
Oh, the parents were happy.
Oh, everybody was happy as a camper.
Well, Charles, thank you for your time. Always, I love listening to you and picking your brain on what's going on. It's always interesting.
Well, I appreciate you saying it because with you guys, it's a genuine conversation. It really is.
If you want to read more Charles Lipson, follow him on Twitter at Charles_Lipson or go to charleslipson.com and you'll see all his stuff that he writes for all these fascinating publications where you can find it all. My only concern,
yes,
I'm asking this of everybody now, is go not only read what people you like, get out of your silo and read, make yourself a promise that of the next five articles you read, three will be from people you disagree with.
Be sure to take your high blood pressure medicine before doing so.
I don't read the Tribune because my blood pressure is so high that I don't want it to pop, you know?
But nice to talk to you guys.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, Charles.
Bye, Charles. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair, writer, talker, thinker, professor. You could read him at charleslipson.com. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, my friend and co-host here. Master of cats, baker of pies. He doesn't bake me any more pies because I can't eat his pies. But we did have a great Indian lunch, though, Indian dinner.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
It was fantastic. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of johncastnews.com. As long as you keep subscribing, I'll keep writing. Deal? Listen to us again for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.